So hello, thank you for tuning in to Rising CNY with Lakia K. Hill. I'm very excited about this episode today with Ryan Binns, investor, developer, serial entrepreneur, educator, so many things. How do you, Ryan, how would you identify yourself, or how do you introduce yourself in the business world, but then also as a human being?
Look, thanks for having me. My first podcast. Oh, yeah. So this is a wonderful time, and I'm glad to do it with you. You ask, how do I identify myself? Mm-hmm. And I think the first thing is just a human. And I've always been an empath in general. So everything that we've been fortunate enough to do, I always try to find a community angle. And with my partners, you know, whenever we take on new projects, we have a hierarchy of what it is that, like, before we do a project. And it's mm-hmm. always community development. Is it profitable and is it fun? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's those three things. So, you know, we've done a lot of wonderful things, but I kind of look at it in that lens. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've been fortunate to kind of check those boxes with everything to date. So, but I just look at myself as a human that has an obligation to try to raise those up around me in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And we try to do that through either entrepreneurial efforts, new businesses, or the, you know, not-for-profits that we support, all those mm-hmm. things.
Good. And we're going to dig into a little bit about that as we move forward into the episode. But first, I would love for my audience and my listeners to get to know you a little bit. So tell me, where you're from and where'd you go to school?
I'm a Syracuse guy. So born in the city, Syracuse. I was here until I was maybe 5 or 6 years old. We moved out to Liverpool. Mm-hmm. I'm one of 6 kids, born and raised essentially in Liverpool or in central New York. Graduated from high school in 2001. Funny enough, not a lot of people know this, but I was not the best student. Mm-hmm. So it actually took me like 6 years to get my 4-year degree, you know, mm-hmm. ultimately. And I transferred a couple of times within that. Got my undergraduate degree in trumpet performance. Took a bunch of jobs in sales, kind of floating in my early 20s. Always had an entrepreneurial passion, and I had started some businesses, and some did okay. And ended up going back to school for business at SU. And after that, I got into real estate, and that really changed my life from there.
Right. I saw that. It said your degree is in entrepreneurship and emerging
enterprises.
Emerging enterprises, entrepreneurship and emerging enterprises. I didn't even know there was a degree in emerging enterprises. That's how much I know. So is that what that experience prior to, you know, being in sales in your early 20s and the difficulty throughout school that you had, is that how you landed on, like, I should become an entrepreneur? Because it's such a, I feel like entrepreneurship is like a free world in a sense. Like, you can be anyone as long as you have the drive, the ambition, the ideas. This is more about like your makeup as who you are as a human being versus like being very skilled, particularly at something at first, I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll also say that I grew up in an entrepreneurial family.
Okay.
You know, so my father had, he owned a restaurant, a catering company. My mom was always right there, you know, by his side, and they did a lot of these things together. I have uncles that own businesses. Like, there was always a sense of like, you can go this route, which is a more conventional route. And then in a lot of moments in my life, my parents did have regular jobs. You know, not everyone was a lot of folks. There's mm-hmm. a lot of failures and there's a couple of successes, and you try to balance mm-hmm. those. You know, I will say though that through all of those, there was always this instilled feeling of like, just do it. You know, like, life happens. And I think that that's partly instilled from my parents. That level of support, you know, has never been, you know, questioned, you know, so they're always like, okay, like, of course you're going to do that. Go, you know, go, good luck, you know?
Oh.
So there's a sense of that I absolutely grew up in. So I think with the support of the family, you know, even after I went to school for music and I was a freelance trumpet player in New York,
right.
You know, I always had this sense, as I was kind of saying before, that I wanted to do 100 things, mm-hmm. you know. So it was a natural fitting for me to decide to go back to grad school, to go for entrepreneurship. By that time and through college, I had started a couple of companies. One of them did fairly well. We actually invented a type of a music transcription notebook. Mm-hmm. I ended up selling it to like 500 music stores around the United States. And not that I made a lot of money, but I had a great experience and I learned a lot. So I just always had this, like, you know what? They say big risks make good stories.
Yeah.
You know, so you just have to like figure it out and go and do something. And especially when you're in your earlier portions of your life, what's the worst that can happen? Mm-hmm. What's the worst, you know? And at the time I was doing these things, I still had other jobs. You know, it's not like I, you know, there's a failure to launch unless you actually get up and go and do these things. So at the same time, you have to mitigate your risk. Mm-hmm. So my first jobs, even, and I can chat more about our retail stores in New York City. My wife was working multiple other jobs. I was working other jobs at the same time as we were doing these things, because that's what it takes to really get something up and running. It's very challenging just to say, all right, I'm going to go do this and have it be everything that you want it to be. So there's a lot to that.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I obviously I had to do some research and some digging, which I'm really good at. And then I found out this is something I didn't know about you as we've been beginning to build our relationship, was that you owned a women's boutique store, Lily's Forest, in the business district of New York City. I had no idea.
We had three locations down there.
Really? How long do you still own it, or is it?
So she shut down, Lily shut down at the start of the pandemic, unfortunately. And, you know, actually that was the first real success we had, you know, and it's so funny because that little boutique store, our first location at the South Street Seaport in New York, our first location was 400 square feet. It was a tiny little retail space in the old Pier 17 mall. And at the time, a friend of mine's friend rented out a little space in that same Pier 17 mall for $500 a month. And he started a little wine bar. And I heard the story. I'm like, what the hell? Like, for $500 a month, I can sell anything in New York City and I'll make money, you know? And my wife and I, we went into that business with that mindset. Was like, we signed the lease for $500 a month on a 400 square foot space. We had no idea what we were going to sell. And we signed the lease. And 3 days later, so over the next 3 days, we had no money. We started this whole business on, it was like $1,800 of credit card debt. That I put $1,000 on like products that we found, you know, from around town that we could resell. And then I spent $800 on like cheap LVT flooring and some wall fixtures and stuff like that to make the space so cute. My wife and I, we took my car, we drove around Brooklyn and we found discarded furniture. And I'm talking like coffee tables, a woman's chest, you know, things like that. And we made the store just look beautiful with the scraps of people's garbage that we found on the streets in Brooklyn. And the store was incredible because when you were walking by, it was on an inside mall. But when you would walk by the store, what we did with all of these pieces that we found was I flipped them upside down and I suspended them from the ceiling. And all of the garments were hanging off the side of a coffee table where I would drill holes and the hangers would, you know, hang inside of there. So aesthetically, it was just like, oh my, this little wonderland, you know, places that you'd walk through. And I want to say this again, because I think it's so important. My wife, she was working three jobs at the time that we had this store, and I had a couple of jobs. At that time, I was selling credit card processing bodega to bodega around Queens and Brooklyn, you know, and we just saved up every single penny from that retail store. And then we had the chance to move that store. And then we moved again to our biggest location down in the financial district of New York. And everything we've built has been based off of that initial investment. We ended up expanding that concept to three locations across the tri-state area, one in Jersey and then two in New York. And it was just a beautiful way to learn, you know, kind of together. My wife, in fact, it's funny because our relationship was so young at that time. We were only dating.
I was going to ask you, let's for the audience and even for myself, around what time period is all of this happening?
Well, you know, the reason they were doing such cheap deals at the South Street Seaport at this time was because it was right after Hurricane Sandy. So all of the financial district was decimated. The Howard Hughes Corporation had just bought the mall from General Growth Properties via bankruptcy. So they were just filling the space in with some short-term opportunities to bring activity and life back to that area. So in fact, my wife and I were just chatting over the weekend. We just celebrated 7 years of marriage. So yesterday was our anniversary.
Congratulations.
But 10 years as entrepreneurs together.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So our relationship has been so many things, you know, within that course, but all based on love, I'll say.
All based on love. That is the root of, and she's so beautiful. She's such a sweet woman. She's so beautiful. I love seeing you two together and how you guys support one another. So
I think that if any of your listeners are partners with their significant other, and I swear to God, this is true for us, we would give the whole thing up for the basis of the relationship. Fuck the money. Fuck anything else that, you know, it has to be all about the family first.
Yes.
So we've always been very clear about our priorities with that. And there's moments where, not to say it stresses the relationship, but like where we mutually understand like, hey, we need to pull back here, or, you know, let's take some time and all those kinds of things.
I can appreciate that. I think that in so many times we just see the visual, we see the optics of a power couple per se, if that's what you want to call it, or a husband and wife team or duo. But very rarely do we hear about the stress that you know, that can put on a relationship and what best practices are in place or that couples use to survive that and to thrive through, you know, their entrepreneurial journey or their business partnership than their love life and their romantic partnership. I mean, I'm still single. Let's just put that out there. This may go overseas somewhere. My future husband might be over there just to let him know. But I just want to let him know what we're getting into and what he's getting into and what I
anticipate.
God, I need that support or we need to work together as a team. But I do have a lot of friends, quite a few friends who are married, but they've gone into business together and either it impacted the relationship because of money mostly and time. They weren't able to be successful in their marriage and either kept the business relationship or they had to let one or the other go. So that's good to know that, you know, you guys are very conscious about that with one another.
I don't sit here pretending that I know the answers. I'll say what's worked for us is that recognition. It's a truthful relationship. And it's not always been, you know, smooth, like I said, but you just have to be mature enough and you have to go into it knowing what's your priority.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if your priority is to start a business and quote unquote get rich or something like that, like then don't jeopardize your personal relationship if that's what your goal is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think one of the things that made perhaps us unique and blessed is that it was never about trying to grow a business. It was about having fun together. And when we first opened up Lily's Forest, it was a short-term lease. It was $500 a month. It was a 90-day lease, the first one was. And we said, well, what the heck? Let's not take a paycheck. Let's save up as much money and let's go on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And our only goal was to go on that vacation because we had no money at this time. Like we were living in New York and we had no money. You know, like I said, this whole thing started out in debt. So the goal, I guess, was to pay off the credit card debt and then, you know, have $5,000 left over and go on vacation. Mm-hmm. But I think that sense of like, no, we're in this together. Everything from that point on forward is simply a blessing.
Mm-hmm.
That if you're not willing to, you know, make sure that your priorities maintain the blessing and like have that appreciation for it, as soon as it starts changing, like to why you do these things, as if it's for the economic benefit, like forget it, man, because you miss the whole point of why you're here in general.
Right.
You know, you got to have that as your basis.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing it. And thank you for entrusting me by digging a little deeper into your personal side. And I think it's important because it frames where we're going now. So that's the beginning. There's school. You meet the love of your life. You guys want to have fun together. You love each other. You start a business together. You're learning how to be in this dynamic relationship, but also with you finding and saying, okay, what do I want to do next? Taking risk. Now, here we are. You're coming back home. You said, okay, what was it? I want to come back to Syracuse to cultivate this community. What was that thing that made you say, I'm going back home. I want to build. I want to develop. I want to create this communal space and help downtown become a livable space and place for people? Like, what was that thing that brought you back here?
At the time, so my son, our son, was born in New York in 2018. So we kind of knew, as my wife was pregnant, and we kind of knew like our time in New York was coming to an end. You know, when we were transitioning to that next part of life, we did our 20s in New York and early 30s or whatever. And we said, well, what's next? You know, my two favorite words in the world are what's next. And at the time, we looked at a few different cities. It wasn't immediate Syracuse. Now we're both from here. I met my wife and I kind of take a quick step back. I met her playing a gig. I play trumpet and piano at Dinosaur Barbecue. And she was in the audience one night when I was playing with a like a 90s, early 2000s cover rock band called The Boatmen. And she was in the audience that night. So her family was from here, as was mine. We had a lot of friends. But we also were looking, you know, my parents had moved to Florida, you know, by this point. So they're down south. She went to school in Chicago. Weather was a consideration. We looked at San Diego, like out west, like, you know, that'd be nice. And I think what it was like the main thing was, I don't think that we could have gone back to being a 9-to-5 office mentality at mm-hmm. this point. So we knew we wanted to be entrepreneurs and kind of stick in this bubble. And Syracuse, I mean, this is like 5 years ago. So like 10 years before that, you know, going back 15, 20 years, Syracuse has been on a tremendous upswing. There's been a ton of vibrancy and passion. And I say regularly, like we all stand on the shoulders of the people that, you know, before us.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so many people that created the energy that we wanted to be a part of. We did not create it, but we just wanted to live in that energy and be part of something bigger than us. That's human nature. Everybody wants to be part of something bigger than themselves. And we felt by coming to Syracuse, we could be a part of that. We could make investments, contribute positively, we hope. And we didn't think that we could have that same level of investment in Chicago or Florida or anywhere else. So when we came up here, we said, you know, we are blessed because of Lily's Forest that, you know, we decided to get into real estate when we got up here. We bought some buildings. And as they say, the rest is history. But it was that sense of like, we wanted to, if we're going to come here, be part of that change. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're just so optimistic about the future of Central New York. I mean, certainly over the last 5 years since being back here. Mm-hmm. But even before that, it was just, it had a new personality. It had a new sense of optimism that we wanted to be participating in.
For me, I came here in 2013 and, you know, I'm from New York, so downstate. So when I came here, it was not anything. Like, one, the stores closed very early. They were closed at like 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock. There wasn't a lot of businesses down on South Salina Street that you can shop in. It was so foreign to me culturally, you know, and I questioned, I was like, what is this place? What's going on? Right. And I also didn't see any Black and brown people. You know, I talk about race a lot in my background in diversity work. And one of the reasons why I wanted you on here is because I know that you're very socially and economically conscious as well. But what made you say, OK, I want to start developing downtown Syracuse, like when in Salina, North Salina area, this is a good time period for us to invest our money and our time in doing that? Well,
I don't know what came first, though, because I want to go back to 2015 for you for a second.
Okay. Though,
because for a long time, so I grew up here in Central New York, right? And I remember I was born in 83. I remember the 90s as a teenager and early 2000s, like nobody came home to Syracuse. It was like, well, where are you going to go after you graduate or something like that? Or mm-hmm. where are you going to school? But few people would stay here. And so you have this dilapidated city that sat there for 15 years, you know, 18, you know, 15 to 20 years, somewhere in that range, between like mid 90s and 2012, 15, somewhere in that timeline. Again, I stand on the shoulders of other people. So there was early 2000s, there was beginning to be what you're describing. There was a sense of like, all right, well, we can't have this, you know, continue to be like this. And I will say, thank God, I need to speak from a financing perspective for a second, because historic tax credits make so much of the development across Central New York possible because we have historic districts.
Okay.
So when you look at, almost every development project in Central New York, going back to the early 2000s, mid 2000s, like 10, 12, somewhere in that range, almost all of them are financed because of the tax credits that were eligible to developers at that time. But now what's funny, and what I don't know is comes first, is do the development mentality, did they follow the upswing of we need to revitalize this? Or was there this sense of optimism that says, well, we're not going to let this happen? You know, and I don't know. But I will say what's a really important psychological change in this community that's happened since the 90s to where we are today is in the 90s and early 2000s, people didn't know why you were here. So if you were from downstate New York and you came to Syracuse, yeah, they'd say, why? Mm-hmm. Why would you do that? And now people say, yeah, come on up.
Yes.
Like, come be part of the party now, you know?
Yeah.
And the secret weapons that we've had for a long time that I love Center State and I love what the county executive has done mm-hmm. and the advocacy and at the state level, our secret weapons up here are not becoming secret anymore. And that's a really important differentiation for the Amazons and the Microsofts and the Micron and every other company that's come this way. Mm-hmm. We are the best from an ROI perspective for business. Mm-hmm. Where you have affordability in terms of, and I understand it's not as affordable as it should be, but I'm talking relative to national averages, we are extremely affordable to live in. We have a high quality of life, you know, for those families and for the children. We have some of the best educational opportunities. We have some of the best parks, with the exception of some inclement weather, which, by the way, it's not even 4 months. It's like 4 storms a year. It sucks for those 4 days, right? So maybe 7 or 8 days if you include the extra day after that. Otherwise, it's a little cold to put a jacket on.
Mm-hmm.
There's
right.
so much more optimism now that I think is a really important part of this whole last 15 years. Forget the development stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So to answer your question, like Salina Street, we wanted really to be focusing on like, well, how do you continue to change that perception? What we're trying to do is change hearts and perspectives of what Central New York is. So when we bought the Whitney Lofts, it was 2 dilapidated buildings from 1855 on Salina Street. They were like in the middle of the heart, which is, you know, Salina Street is like the heart of downtown Syracuse. And they were the ugliest buildings on the block. So we said, all right, well, let's buy those. We took advantage of the tax credits that I mentioned, which made the development possible. We did not pocket those tax credits. It made it subsidized the development itself. And all of a sudden, and then we built the restaurant, Oh My Darling. But again, even the name of that was so intentional to ensure that Salina Street for years, for decades, if you want to go get stabbed, you go to Salina Street, mm-hmm. right? If you're walking up, like that's where you get mugged or that's where you find your precarious situations, right? So we wanted to change the perspective of what Salina Street could mean, could right. stand for, could represent. And when you have two beautiful buildings with apartments upstairs and then you have a restaurant with a feminine name intentionally, Oh My Darling, which is across Solana Street, 25 feet letters wide, it changes the context of what that street can be. And all of a sudden, if you're, and I think that the biggest roadblock that Central New York continues to have, or I'll say Syracuse, the city, has is like, well, how do we get people from Baldwinsville or Manlius to come downtown? And because those are the folks that are have some affluency and they live there because they're not to say afraid of downtown, but they might work there, but they don't play there.
Right.
So we needed to change the perspective of what Solana Street could represent and the synergy with the landmark and the Red House, and then complemented that with, again, we stand on the shoulders. So what VIP Structures did with Original Grain across the street, and they really turned the Pike Block corner of development on Fayette and Armory Square, kind of all of a sudden now it's coming down Solana Street. So it was this organic, natural expansion of what so many folks before us were doing. And like I said, we want to be part of that, but then have our own, it's okay to be part of this community, you know, sense, sense to it.
And that's what I get now. That's where I was going. It's just like from the time when I first came here in 2013 to what I see today or in the last 5 years per se, it's amazing. And now I was that person, you know, when someone would say to me, well, why are you here? When I first moved here, I would ask myself that same question.
Right.
Like, why am I here? Why did I come here? Like, you know, I did not want to stay, but I came here for a purpose. So my whole journey here is very different. I don't want to get into that now, but I still would find myself not happy, very unhappy, to be honest. And then I started thinking, I have to leave. And then I didn't. You know why? Because I would say I can pinpoint 5 years ago is when I literally started to see that shift and that change. And what you did just now was put some context to how I began to see it. And so I hear you talk a lot about experience, like the individuals or the humans' experience when they come into your spaces, and that's important to you.
Well, I want to mention one thing. There's something called neurological architecture.
Okay,
which is
thank
my
you.
Favorite thing in the world to think about. Our retail store down in New York, Lely's Forest, I think was successful for a couple of reasons. But one of them was the music that we played in that retail store when you walked in was 1950s doo-wop music. And people would just like lose themselves whistling and clapping and singing along. And what that did was it extended the duration of their experience in the store. They had a positive connotation of the store. They spent more money in the store. Forget what we sold. It was how do you feel when you're in the space? And I believe tremendously from a retail customer service perspective, and this is everything is quote unquote experiential retail now, whether it's a restaurant or a retail experience. It's not what do you do, it's how do you feel when you're in the space. So we try to take that same feeling to Oh My Darling when we built that. And Central New York, again, it's transitioning. So first of all, we have a lot of gray days and a lot of rainy days. Nothing I can do about that. But when you walk into our space, I did not want it to feel like a dark tavern, you know, or some kind of a, you know, like a pub. We intentionally wanted it to be bright and airy and open. And the music that we play is specific. It tends to have a lot of horns, almost like Chicago, Earth, Wind, and Fire. There's like modern versions of that kind of feel, you know, music now. But it's intentional in terms of when you walk in, what is the smell? What does it look like? And how do you feel? And from that, I use this analogy often, like if a family were to go to Red Robin, right, and spend $11 on a burger, or go into Oh My Darling and spend $17, why are they going to do that? Now, there's a few things. One, I have to offer a higher premium product, which we do. But then it's also, there's more perceived value based off of how we feel as opposed to just going to another chain and spending, you know, $12 on a burger. I'm not getting an experience out of this. I'm consuming food with my family in a public place. It's not an experience. And we're very conscientious about, well, how do you create an experience for every guest while adding not just perceived, but adding value?
Right. And when I walk in, I feel like I'm entering into a new area. So we talked a little bit about Oh My Darling. What are some other development projects you have? Let's talk about the bookstore right down the street from it, actually.
We opened up Parthenon Books about a year ago. Again, it goes back to what does a city look like? And what does experiential retail look like? And looking at the changing pendulum of what retail, you know, looks like. So we felt that having a bookstore could establish community, could be a place where people can come out and it adds value to the community just from a walkability perspective, from a streetscape perspective. We do a lot of open mic nights and we give reasons for people to come there aside from just coming to get books. It's kind of part of the psyche of like, well, how do you develop what a city should feel like?
I had a question about that. Like, what are, and I think you've answered this in just organically in some of your responses and what we were talking about, but what are some factors you consider when thinking about developing an area, or what would you say are key factors that one should consider in thinking about before developing in an area?
Well, you know, it depends on what your ambition is. From a retail perspective, I strongly suggest owning the real estate if you're going to do a retail offering. That's not always possible, but it is probably more often possible than people realize, even if you have to condo the building in some way to buy the first floor, as an example, you know. But what that does is it hedges your bets, you know, if you will. You know, we had opened a second restaurant called Luna Loca. You know, it was where the old Mission restaurant was. It was a great restaurant. I think if that restaurant was not in that location, it was maybe in a suburb, I think we would have crushed it. And I just know based off the quality of food, how talented that staff was, we had a great concept. I think there were some challenges with the business model. Namely, I think we were too cheap. And the number of the profit per person was just too small of a restaurant to actually turn a profit on that. But where we hedged our bet was that I bought the building. So when we had issue with the restaurant, we lost money on the restaurant, but then we ended up being recouped by owning the real estate itself when we sold that building. It's a developer's way to, you know, from a retail perspective, just to make sure that you have a way to kind of recoup your money in the event that the retail offering does not advance. If you were to look at that project, it checked all of our boxes. It took an old historic building that had no function. You know, it was an old restaurant that had closed. So we bought the building. From a community perspective, we love food and beverage. Restaurants as a category, I call them cultural anchors. Mm-hmm. And that, like, it forces people to come out, and that's a moment, you know, is right there. So we love that. And we thought it was fun, and we had a great team and all those things too. So, you know, those are some of the things I look for. I look for not only my three boxes, but how do you then mitigate your risk? And that's also true to Oh My Darling. Oh My Darling is a business where we have two entities, the Fitz, our speakeasy, plus Oh My Darling, under one LLC, under one liquor license, under a building that we also own, so that if anything happens, all right, I lease it to somebody else. But it's hedged in some way. The bookstore is the same thing. Luna Loca was the same thing. We're developing another concept right now on another property we own. Because it's something that we own, it's going to add value to the property as well as give us that opportunity. So I believe the ownership of the real estate is critically important.
Thank you for sharing that. The other thing is, now it sounds like the same question, but it's not. Now this is more about you. What's your process for you? What's your process before you build or slash develop? Like, what are the steps you take yourself through when you're about to launch?
Well, for a couple of things. So I think we have 8 active projects right now, right? Mm-hmm. So they're all different phases, you know, and some shopping town, as an example,
yeah, like that's
going to start construction at some point in the future, 12 months from now, right? But we've been working on that project for 2 years, you know. Other projects, the Penfield building, it's in the midst of construction, you know. So to source the projects and to kind of figure out, like, what projects are we going to take on? Part of it goes to bandwidth. I'd say community change. I'd say, how do I want to spend my time? How do I think I can operate this or get it? You know, so most of our properties, we have a property management company, Acropolis, that manages that for us, which is wonderful. And it gives you that peace of mind.
Next, you mentioned Shopping Town, and that was my, as we begin to close, save the best for last. I call it the best for last because it's such a huge development project. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about the Shopping Town project that you are doing, and what are some of the things we can expect from it?
Well, again, from Syracuse, that's a property I had driven by 1,000 times. And I had known that the county had, I mean, it's all public knowledge, that the county had acquired the property. And as part of when somebody, like a county owns something, they have to issue an RFP. So I made sure that our foot was ready so that, you know, when the RFP was issued, we would receive it. And then that in my mind checks all of my boxes, right? That is significant community change, positively, I hope. I think it's a lot of fun to create something like that. And we hope it's going to be financially, you know, solvent. So my first call, I called a good friend of mine, Andy Brewer from Huber Brewer Construction Company. I called another good friend of mine, Ben Lockwood from Housing Visions, a partner of ours on the Penfield project, which I'm very proud of Shopping Town, but I'll be more proud when it's actually constructed.
Right.
Yes. But in terms of, like, things I'm proud of in my life, Penfield, I am far more proud of that project, which is 128 mixed income projects in partnership with Housing Visions. But, you know, it's been 2 years since we've been awarded the RFP. It is an extremely laborious process to consolidate the site control because we do not have full development rights to the full site. which inhibits us from developing anything at all. So until we finalize that site control, which I can say we're close to, or potentially requesting the IDA's use of eminent domain, which we hope to avoid. I mean, that's not our goal at all. But until you can consolidate that, there's not much you can do.
Right.
Every company that I mentioned, in Dalpas Architecture, another one of our partners, every one of my partners on this deal, including ourselves, are experienced developers. And we really were intentional on putting together the best development team possible in Central New York. We have a fantastic infrastructure program. We need to demo the existing mall. We need to put in new streets. We have 5 acres of parks, you know, that we're building. We're building a beautiful pavilion and community center that's over there. And then I think it just goes to the market conditions of the project 5 years from now. You're really developing the project of 2028, you know, more than anything else.
Right. Right.
So residential is important. A new movie theater on that side of town is important, you know, for establishing that sense and that place. We have a lot of interest on the medical side for office medical spaces over there. We have fantastic retail opportunities. The Marshalls Plaza across the street is booming, you know, and there's additional opportunities there. So we see that as strategic community infill that will add value to the overall marketplace while kind of checking the needs of housing, of quality retail, of a movie theater. And we're very blessed to be the ones spearheading that effort. The county and the IDA has been very supportive. I absolutely could not be here without them. But there's still just, in reality, a lot more work to do. And we meet multiple times every week. Every week we're going through that process. And we'll get to that point as soon as we can.
Right. Ryan, thank you so much again for taking the time to sit with me and to open up and share with my listeners for Rising CNY. And your level of humility is just so warming, and just, I'm glad to see it, you know, and that we want to challenge a lot of narratives that are just like dated outside of like humanity, and kind of center us all to be more human centered as a society. And I think our region is just very lucky and blessed to have you. So
thanks.
Thank you so much for having you here.
I appreciate you thinking of me.
Yes, of course, always. And that, ladies and gentlemen, comes the closing of this episode of Rising CNY with Lakia K. Hill. Thank you so much for your time and for tuning in. And you have a blessed day as well. Bye.